Live to see it, friends, and welcome to The World Transformed. This program is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead, one that will be here sooner than you think, and one that you have an important role to play in bringing about. At The World Transformed, we want to introduce you to what may be the greatest transformation of them all, the one that begins with considering and acting on the almost limitless possibilities that lie before us, and that ends somewhere beyond the reach of the human imagination. So, when does this amazing future begin? Well, today is the day. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
I am super fantastic. How are you, my friend?
I'm doing great. Very excited about the second in this new series that we're doing. We started it on Monday night, didn't we? So
Yes, we did. We did seven big questions about the future on Monday, and tonight we're doing seven more big. And because it's Wednesday, I'm throwing in an amazing questions about the future of humanity. Actually, it's not that the questions are amazing, come to think of it, it's our answers have to be amazing. These questions.
On Wednesday, we amp up the amazingness, right? I mean, we're right in the middle of the week. You know, we're not just starting the week. We're not. You know, ready to party at the end of the week. We're bringing our worker selves to this problem, right? So
that's right. You know, they talk about Wednesday being the hump day, but for us, that hump is peak amazing right there. Okay, that's when
exactly.
That's when we bring it every week, every week. And you'll see even from the first question that that we truly are onto the amazing at this point. But I just want to note that what we're working through is a list of 20 big questions about the future of humanity from scientificamerican.com, and follow the link there in the show notes if you want to read more about what their panel of experts say about these questions. But on this program, of course, you get to hear from us, the two of us, about what we think. And we'll start with number 8 on the list, a subject that we tend to avoid on this show, sex. But here's an interesting question. Will sex become obsolescent? And we have an answer from Henry Greeley, director of the Center for Law and the Biosciences at Stanford University. He takes the question quite clinically. He answers whether sex will be necessary in the future for human procreation, and his answer is no, it won't. And we've seen evidence of that even last week. I think there was an interesting story about a future where you won't need an egg to make a baby, which is really kind of astounding stuff. But it, right in line with the prediction he's making, that that sex, in order to produce people, will become a lot less common. And I think, you know, there could be something to that. But my take on will sex become obsolescent is that while procreative sex may be on the way out, we're probably not even scratching the surface. We haven't even begun the golden age of recreational sex. I don't think, you know, in terms of a thing people do, I don't think sex is going anywhere. What do you think, Stephen?
I agree completely. You go visit with somebody that has a garden in their backyard and ask them, well, mm-hmm. were you guys hungry? Why did y'all need this garden in the back of your yard? It's not because they were hungry and they had no other way of getting food. They enjoy getting outside and doing what it is they're gardening, right? People
right.
are not, you know, long after the need to have sex to reproduce has been overcome, or I guess that's the right way to say that, people will still have sex. It's not something you normally have to really push on people, right? I mean, you need to really take care of your teeth, Bill. Get to the dentist, you know, and have them cleaned twice a year, and and it's a pain, I know, but you got to do it. And also, you know, have sex. You know, it's good for you. You know,
and yeah,
one
yeah,
or the other.
That's right.
One of those two things is hard to do. The other is not so much, right?
That's right. You don't hear people, you know, nagging other people to reminding them. I know you don't want to do this, but you don't think, you know.
Exactly. It doesn't typically fall into that.
Yeah.
That's right.
Because
so
that's a good point. Although generationally, it's interesting to see that they say that millennials have been less interested in sex than generations that came before them, that Generation Z coming up behind them, also less interested. There's an interesting phenomenon in Japan where they've got a growing number of virgins in the country. Now,
Yeah.
I would say that that is all, it kind of obscures the issue a little bit because, you know, while procreative sex may become less important, the other thing that may become less important is having a human partner for sex as robotic sex becomes a bigger thing. I think the idea that people are less sexual, I'm not seeing it, I'm not buying it. That interesting alternatives to people having sex with each other have arisen in recent years and are about to become, you know, more distinct and more effective. There's going to be people doing it in completely new ways in completely new contexts. But again, right. To me, that just goes with the fact that we're probably going to see a lot more sex, not less than we have in the past.
Well, call me old-fashioned, but with billions of other potential sex partners in this world, robotic sex, it's going to have to get a whole lot better, you know, before it the good old-fashioned kind of goes away.
Sounds like an option, yeah.
Yeah. That's me being old-fashioned for once. I'm usually not so old-fashioned.
Hey, you know, let me say that there's an analogy to vat meat here. And I'm just going to leave it at that, okay? The technology's got to be there before.
Yeah, but it's going to have to get a whole lot better before a lot of us start eating that meat. We're talking, of course, about the cultured meatballs that we're seeing on the lately. So anyway, whatever. Yeah, it's got to get a whole lot better.
Before, it's not a porterhouse yet.
Or you order exactly. A steak that. Yeah, we don't have a porterhouse yet.
All right.
Exactly.
This is too much fun. We've gone
down that road, right?
We must move on. We've got right. More of these. All right. The next question: could we one day replace all the tissues in the human body through engineering? And once again, it's that David Koch. Well, this time Institute. Yeah, professor at the Massachusetts at MIT, Robert Langer. He says, yes, we can. And he talks about two approaches that we would take to that. One is I think he primarily focuses on the first one I'm going to mention, which is creating synthetic alternatives to the parts of the body that we have now. And I think there's more than one approach to doing that, but I tend to agree with his yes. I just think that it will be synthetics as well as, you know, we can grow whole, fresh, new, compatible, fully compatible parts of the body using stem cells. So between those two technologies, I think that we will definitely be able to replace all the tissues in the human body. What do you think?
Well, you know, we've talked about this before. Which do we get first? Do we get Luke Skywalker's hand, you know, which is fully
right.
Mechanical, right? Or do we get the ability to regrow a hand? And which would we prefer? Right now, it's back to the bat meat thing again. It's going to have to be a whole lot better. Synthetics are going to have to be a whole lot better before we prefer that to being able to regrow the real thing, right?
Right.
So, obviously, right now, what we would want is the ability to regrow the hand and other parts and every other part of the body. You know, I mean, if you got something wrong with your liver, wouldn't it be awesome if we could regrow a liver? I'm mentioning Dr. McCoy again. Wouldn't, you know, give him a pill and regrow a kidney?
Doctor gave me a pill and I grew a new kidney.
Yeah, that's what we, you know, obviously we would love that. The ability to in vivo regrow the things that are damaged or old or whatever. And just keep trucking as if it never, you know, had that problem. Do we get there? Yeah, I think we do. And I think we see a whole lot of strides in this in pretty short order. I think I would be surprised, Phil, if in 10 to 15 years, we're not regrowing, hands and things like that. And slowly being able to phase out things like organ transplants just by being able to regrow organs that are damaged or are having problems like that. So, yeah.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think this is one where I would somewhat rephrase the question, because the question is, will we one day, could we one day replace all the tissues in the human body through engineering? The actual question is, how will we? Because I think everyone agrees, or you know, it's almost universally agreed that we're going to have that ability. It's just a matter of how we're going to go about it.
I don't foresee myself wanting, you know, to, we got this new part. Okay, great. Put it on me, you know, and slowly become something synthetic or something like that. I think that what we have is something a little more organic, where we regrow things that are damaged or old or whatever. And so, anyway, I guess I'm making a point there.
I think so too.
I see a slightly different future than what the question presumes, I think.
Well, I will get better. Every 18 months. You know, will I at some point get new eyes every 18 months or so? Or will there, you know, will they just... It's part of a bigger context and a bigger set of discussions there. But one way or another, the damage gets fixed. I think that's the really interesting and compelling part of this, whether it's done by electronics being implanted, putting in a whole new organ, or simply being much more effective at repairing what's already there. One way or another, we're getting a lot better at that. Okay, question number 10, can we avoid a sixth extinction? And we've got a professor from Harvard University named Edward O. Wilson, he talks in terms of loss of habitat. If we can maintain habitat for other species, then we can avoid the big extinctions that have occurred in the past. What I read from what he's saying is, if we keep destroying habitat, then we're causing the next big extinction. So if we stop doing that, then we prevent that big extinction. And I think, you know, that argument works as far as it goes. But these previous extinctions have been, you know, kind of cataclysmic, whereas we've been more of a, I don't know, kind of a, you know, long-term cataclysm. I guess, you know, humanity has been fairly cataclysmic if you look at, like, the last couple centuries.
Right.
But ultimately, I think this one goes to kind of just the role we play. If you go back to the question we talked about on Monday about whether humanity will survive long-term, I think if we're around, we're quickly transitioning from being the agent of extinction to being the big preventer of extinction. As bad as we've been as an agent of extinction, I think we're going to become that much even better a preventer of extinctions from occurring, and that ultimately the fact that a sixth extinction won't occur will be credited to humanity, right? That we will keep it from happening. That's my very optimistic take. What do you think?
I'm going to join you in that. We are becoming more urbanized, society is, so we're not pushing out into habitats as much as we used to, and also the more developed we become, we tend to slow in our population growth too, and some of the most developed places in the world actually have negative population growth. So so if we develop as a world and urbanize, and then become better stewards of flora and fauna. And one of the ways we do that is, you know, we see things like Craig Venter doing the sequencing of all kinds of life. We basically build a library of everything. And if we see that some particular form of life is struggling because of maybe our activity, we encourage it in some way, right? You know, we can
exactly.
Even bring things back from extinction, perhaps. I think we've become, instead of agents of destruction in this library, we become the librarians, and we take care of it. So perhaps that's it's part of growing up as a species, I think, and we're getting there.
Yeah, it's a role we've been trying to assume for several decades now, and you know, doing that while still causing a lot of extinctions. So you know, we're not perfect, and it's unfortunate that overlap is occurring, but it's just kind of how humans do things, right? We get better incrementally. We're not perfect. And
Put it this way, some of the same development that's allowing us to be horrible agents of destruction will be the things that allow us ultimately to take the wheel a little bit. And
that's
and
the paradox, isn't it? Absolutely.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, I agree. That's kind of why you don't get that perfect. Well, we'll just stop making extinctions occur tomorrow, and from now on, we'll just protect them. It's not going to happen that way, unfortunately. I think the tide is definitely turning even now. All right, how about this one? Related question number 11, can we feed the planet without destroying it? And here we have Pamela Ronald. She's a professor in the Genome Center at the University of California, Davis. And she says that we definitely can. And she gives a kind of a standard public policy answer, also a kind of a standard California answer around reducing consumer waste and cutting down meat consumption, et cetera. And I don't mean to critique, you know, I don't mean that as criticism of that answer. I think it's a pretty good answer. But what do you think, Stephen? A more specialist kind of answer to can we feed the planet without destroying it? What do you think?
As far as the meat goes, I think we'll have ways of getting meat in the future that don't involve the killing of animals. And we've already alluded to that in this show. And I think that's a big part of it.
Yeah.
Protein's important and people need it. And, but the ranching and farming of animals, it's very destructive to the environment. And, it's also cruel to the animals. And I say that as I enjoy my hamburgers, you know, I'm not a vegan by any means, but given the opportunity to move from, meat that requires the death of an animal and environmental destruction to meat that doesn't and that tastes just as good, I'm going to make that jump in a heartbeat. And I know you would too, Phil.
Right.
So I think the vast majority of people in the developed world would. And so that's a big part of it. And of course, there's been developments even back in the 70s, the dwarf wheat that allows two crops to be grown of wheat in the same, you know, on the same land that used to only provide one crop a year of wheat, that prevented, you know, world starvation. That was developed, I believe, at Texas A&M, and that was huge.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and there's and other things like golden rice, which is a GM form of rice that, and you know, a lot of people don't like GMs, but I think that's a big part of how we feed the world. We develop things.
And
that,
a big part of how you do it in a way that is good for the environment, too. Absolutely.
That's right. That's right. I mean, it's the people that are most against GMs would call themselves environmentalists, but hey, the GMs would allow, GM crops would allow us to use less pesticides. So get on board, guys. I mean, do a little study and figure it out that, hey, that's what we need to do. So, yeah, there's that. Plus, you know, we're thinking also about urban farms. Giant buildings full of crops that that don't require transportation to get to people, right? And
exactly.
And don't take up a valuable land. We can grow it right there in the middle of the city. So there's all kinds of things that we will do. And I think we can get there.
Yeah, I think the technology of things like vertical farms, you'll also see just this huge explosion in our ability to create yields of food in those kinds of settings. Basically, technology comes in and revamps how we do all of this. We'll still be planting crops on land. I don't mean to suggest that we won't, but between producing meat in a completely different way.
Even that will change substantially. You're going to have self-driving tractors that work 24/7,
right?
And then self-driving delivery trucks that bring us the food, right? I mean, we're going to be able to feed the world. It's going to seem like a silly question, I think, in a few years.
I think so too. I think it comes down to. It comes down to the same thing we said about curing or getting adequate health care to everyone on the previous show. It's a bundle of things that will occur all at once, and it's going to make a tremendous change. Okay, number 12, will we ever colonize outer space? And here we have NASA Planetary Protection Officer Catherine A. Conley giving kind of a mixed bag answer on this. Talking about, yeah, there might be some people, sleeping out in space, right, spending a few days there, maybe even spending part of their lives there, but hedging around full-on colonization. I will take a much simpler and more pragmatic approach. My answer to this question is yes, we will colonize space. What do you think, Stephen?
Yes, we will. And I think it's there are environments that we can improve for the human body. In other words, there are places in the atmosphere of Venus that we could have basically floating cities where oxygen itself is a lifting gas, so that you could have a civilization with roughly the same gravity, which is good, comparable pressure and heat and everything else on Venus. So yeah, that's doable. And rotating space stations would be less fun, I would think, but would be doable. And then of course Mars and even the Moon. I think there are several places in the solar system that would lend themselves to colonization, and it's going to be expensive. It's going to be hard, and we will do it anyway.
So, yeah, exactly. That's what I think. And I'm not even sure the future lies along that path. We've talked about how ultimately space travel, interstellar space travel, and our presence in space becomes more this von Neumann probe, mechanized thing, and it's belongs to the post-humans. But I think we'll at least go through a phase where we're going to be living there as humans, as moshes, mostly original substrate humans. We're going to be out in space, and I think it'll go on for some time anyway. So we're agreed. Okay, number 13, will we discover a twin Earth? And here we have Aki Roberge, a research astrophysicist focusing on exoplanets at the NASA Goddard Space Flight Center, says basically yes. We found lots of other stuff out there. Are we going to find a twin to Earth? Most likely we will. This is another one that I feel pretty comfortable giving a short answer to, but I'll work up to the short answer. Short answer is yes, but the progress that we've made, we talked about a few weeks ago on our 500th anniversary week, in terms of finding other planets, has just been incredible. So, if there's a twin out there, if there is an Earth-like planet to be found, it's just a matter of time. And I don't think it'll be that much time. From being excited about, well, hey, this planet's more like, Jupiter. It's not 10 times as big as Jupiter, to being to saying, well, this one actually is in the Goldilocks zone, to saying, well, this one really does appear to have the kind of, closer to the kind of atmosphere that we're looking for. It seems like we've gotten incrementally closer and closer and closer to this anyway. It feels to me like we're on a trajectory where we find one.
Go ahead. Yeah. I was just going to say, seems like one of the last stories I heard along these lines was rocky planet in the Goldilocks zone, 1.5 times the size of Earth. I think that's about right. As good as we've done so far. But that's amazing because the ability to Earth is small by comparison to, say, Jupiter or something like that. I mean, our ability to look out and see other Jupiters is, we can do that pretty well.
Right.
But the ability to see an Earth is, that's a tough one. And we've gotten better at it in a short period of time. When was the first exoplanet, Phil, I think, that we discovered? Well, I think it was like late 90s, maybe 1998, 99, something like that. Or maybe it was even later than that.
On the current trajectory, it's later than that. I think when we talked about it a couple weeks ago, we were saying it was like 06 when the first really confirmed exoplanet.
Well, put it within a – we didn't – we hadn't even confirmed the first exoplanet in the last 10 years. So I thought it was funny, by the way. I mentioned on Monday that I recently watched Contact. That it was a sci-fi show made in the 90s. And one of the first things she said if we look out on the galaxy, and if there was one in a million stars had planets. That was one of the first things she says. And then one in a million, and there'd still be millions of civilizations. Well, that first statement is laughable now, right?
Right.
One in a million stars had planets. Every star has planets that we can look out on. You know, I mean, that's something we've learned since the 90s when that movie was made.
Yeah, this is another question you could just rephrase. I'll add one word. It's when will we discover the twin Earth, right? Not will we, but just when.
And,
how long till we do?
Put a circle your calendar. I mean, we're in. I would say 6 months from now, Phil, we'll have it. I mean, that's how fast we're moving.
I agree. It's not going to be a big long wait for that.
That's right. Okay.
All right. Finally, for tonight, we got six more for Friday, but finally for tonight, will there ever be a cure for Alzheimer's? And here we have Riesa Sperling. She's the professor of neurology at Harvard Medical School and director for the Center of Alzheimer's Research and Treatment. She talks about very helpful treatments, but is not sure that we'll have what we could call a cure. But talks about progress and you know, definitely alleviating the suffering due to Alzheimer's, having people not get it as quickly and not have it run its course as quickly. What do you think, Stephen? Will we cure Alzheimer's?
I think ultimately yes. It may be easier to prevent it altogether. It may be that we say, well, you know, look, you know, you're in your 50s now, and you know, you need to get in and see a neurologist and you know, begin the process of you know, checking and seeing if you have the markers for this kind of problem coming, and if so, have some treatment to keep, you know, some preventative treatment. That, you know, I could see something like that being an easier thing to prevent than to fix it once the damage is done, once the disease is progressing. But that said, I think that there's hope that ultimately we get some ways to help those who are in the midst of the disease as well. So I'm not ready to, you know, although it's proven to be very tough, I'm not ready to say we'll never do that. I think it's, you know, prevention might end up being easier, ultimately we're able to help those that have too. So.
Yeah, I agree with that. Well, definitely we'll be able to prevent it. I think that, and clearly that's going to be the easier path. The ironic thing about treating it is, ultimately, in my view, we'll be able to treat it up to the very late stages. We'll be able to, you know, treat what we would consider today devastating end of the road Alzheimer's. The thing is, by the time we have that capability, nobody will be getting to that, right? Because we'll be much better at preventing it, and we'll be much better at catching it early. But Alzheimer's, along with most medical conditions, I think we're looking at fully or almost fully preventable, and fully or almost fully treatable. You know, it's not just Alzheimer's. We're going to be able to do that with everything, and including this complicated brain stuff. I'm very optimistic about this one. It seems like they're making real progress on that. We see exciting stuff around Alzheimer's, I don't know, every few months, right? There's a big headline about that, and I don't expect that to change. So, short answer, we're gonna cure Alzheimer's. All right. Well, that's 7 more amazing questions about the future. What do you think, Stephen? You get together on Friday and do 6 more of these?
That sounds great. Maybe do a little other geek too. That's where we look at and have a little fun talking about other things that we think is awesome. So, you know, I'm looking forward to that on Friday.
That sounds like a show. All right. Yeah. Well, thanks, Stephen. It's been great talking to you. Thank you all for being with us. We will be back on Friday with 6 more of these and some other geek. And until next time, live to see it.